Hi, it's Fraser here. You're about to hear a conversation I had with Helen Joyce. This was recorded for Spiked's YouTube channel. If you weren't already aware, Spiked produces regular video content, from a filmed version of the Spiked podcast, to video polemics, to interviews with our favourite thinkers, like this one. So do check out our YouTube channel and subscribe so you never miss a new video.
They've made it taboo to speak about material reality. Young people today think identities and what you identify as is unbelievably important. In schools, children are taught that what makes you a boy or a girl is what you feel like. How do you know what you feel like? You compare it to stereotypes. It's sexist, it's misogynistic. If you're really very gender nonconforming when you're little, you're like 20 times more likely to grow up gay. But those are the people who are now being told they're probably girls. This is modern conversion therapy.
Hello, I'm Fraser Myers, Deputy Editor of Spiked, and I'm delighted to be joined in conversation with Helen Joyce. Helen, you've written the excellent book, Trans: When Ideology Meets Reality. You're Director of Advocacy at Sex Matters. Now, the conversation around trans can often seem quite odd to a lot of people. It can be quite amusing. I mean, just in the week that we're recording this, there's a story about employment tribunal involving a gender fluid dachshund. You often hear about breastfeeding men or academics claiming that Jesus was transgender or Joan of Arc was non-binary. But there is actually something quite serious about this movement. At what point did you realise this was something that you wanted to take on and confront?
Well, I was asked to write about it in 2017. At the time, I was a journalist at The Economist and I edited the international section, which runs long reads. And it was literally, oh, kids are coming home and saying they're trans. You know, and anyone of my age, I'm in my 50s, you know, you might have heard of the occasional person being a transsexual when you were younger, but you understood this as something surpassingly rare and certainly not something that a child would ever say. So I was very open-minded looking into it. I thought, oh, I don't know what's going on here. And I looked, and quite quickly I became quite disturbed because it was clear that the language was all getting messed up.
Yeah.
And so if you can say, you know, if a man can become a woman by saying he's a woman, then you can't have anything that's woman only. Like, that's just a tautology. I'm not saying anything profound there. But funnily, as soon as I said that to people, they would say bigot.
Yeah.
So I remember thinking that the first time I said to somebody, look, if men can identify as women on demand, you are going to get rapists in women's jails, that they would say, oh, didn't think of that. And instead, they just said, you're saying all trans women are rapists, which I'm not.
Yeah.
So quite quickly it became aware that there was an issue, but the people that I mostly agreed with on other things were the ones who were pushing it. So I felt quite uncertain of myself. And I spent about a year just watching it quietly. And then by 2018, I'd become convinced there was a real issue here, that this was the pointy end of a real, you know, a generational shift and a political movement that is causing very profound harm.
Yeah.
And I wrote a big long read, which ran in Quillette that year, which divided it up into the harms that happen to women, to children, and to gay people. And that is still where I think the harms are seen. So for women, it means nothing that's women only. And women are physically weaker. It's women who get raped. It's women, men can too, but I just mean by and large. Men commit nearly all the violent crime. Women need special accommodations because we're the ones who get pregnant and have the babies. If you can't talk about that and organise anything sensibly, it's very bad for women.
Yeah.
Gay people... well, gay people are very gender nonconforming. Like, sleeping with someone of the same sex is the most gender nonconforming thing you can do. And actually, in other ways, gay people are gender nonconforming too. So they're the people who get confused and misallocated as opposite sex people in this movement. So it's quite homophobic. And then for children, well, it's children who are being taught that sex is a spectrum, that your sex is what you say it is, that the way you tell what sex you are is by comparing yourself to gender stereotypes. So it's children who are learning this new ideology and they're identifying as trans and being put on a pathway to medicalization, which is very dangerous. And that's still how I think about it now.
Yeah. No, I want to talk about all those three groups distinctively. But what do you think when a man says that he is a woman or he identifies as a woman, presumably you don't think that's real, but what is really going on in your view?
I don't think it's not real. I think it's like saying that you're a Catholic or that you you know, think it's very serious that you're Piscean or something. I don't have windows into men's souls or men's minds or women's either. If that means something to somebody, that's fine. It's a belief. I feel the problem is when you try and impose it on other people.
Yeah.
And the problem is that's, you know, when people are saying, I'm really a woman, when they're actually men, it is automatically an imposition on other people, because what they mean is the things that are set aside for women, I have access to. Mm. So in the introduction to my book, I say that gender self-ID or gender self-identification is a misnomer. The demand is that other people identify you as the gender you claim to be.
Yeah.
And that's not true for other belief systems. You know, my business partner is an Orthodox Jew, for example. Mm. And of course, when I go to visit him in his house or I go for Friday dinner, I obey the rules. I turn my phone off. I don't touch light switches and so on. But he knows that I don't believe any of that. And he's not telling me that's how I have to live at home. So this is the problem with this one. In my opinion, it's an identitarian movement that has got misclassified. It should be put into the belief category.
Right.
But then you ask, why would somebody believe this? Because it's obviously stupid. It's not possible for a man to know what it feels like to be a woman. You know, identifying as a woman is trivially only a thing that only a man can do.
Yeah.
I can't do it. I just am a woman. Mm. So what is going on for them? Very briefly, for some of them, it's a sexual thrill.
Yeah.
Like, we've known that for decades, that many of the men who say that they want to be seen as women and to dress as women and do whatever behaving as a woman is basically, it turns them on. Mm. Some of them are gay men who traditionally, you know, they're very hyper gay. They're really very interested in things and life roles that are mostly for women. And they've sort of seemed to be more comfortable presenting themselves as women. And I think that recently in the last few years, there's an internet mediated group.
Yeah.
So that's the boys who become very seriously online. Sometimes that's about porn, but sometimes it's not. It's that they're autistic or autistic spectrum. They live their lives in a virtual way and they've become deeply dissociated from their bodies, and they think about avatars and they just think that life might be easier or more interesting as a girl. Or they think, like, tragically, they think that they'd quite like to be, you know, have a sugar daddy, or that life is easier, that you're playing on easy mode if you're a girl.
Yeah.
Like, the grass is always greener.
Definitely. And sticking with maybe it's that latter group, what do you think pornography specifically has played a role in sort of supercharging this?
I mean, we don't know what the way that porn has changed in the last 10 years is doing to us. Like, the studies that were done up to about 10 years ago do seem to suggest that porn doesn't actually do very much to people.
Yeah.
It confirms people's interests, and it doesn't seem, for example, to increase, or it didn't then, increase sexual crimes or any of those things. Like, there wasn't a correlation. I mean, porn became much, much more available at the same time that violent crimes against women went down.
Yeah.
Lots of violent crimes in places where there wasn't much porn, et cetera, et cetera. I think everything has changed with phones, with free porn, with people looking at it much younger. And the thing, I think I call it like the James Bond effect, you know, the way, like, it's, you know, one car and then 10 cars and then 1,000 cars. And then we move into helicopters and then we're in space. Mm. That happens with porn.
Yeah.
And so now what's on porn sites has become just, you know, hyper violent, hyper degrading. You know, just everything has to up the ante constantly. Mm. So, you know, what's that doing to people? Like, I'm not the expert, and I actually couldn't bear to watch it. My friend Joe Bartosz is co-writing a book about this, and I'd be very interested to read it. I will say that about 7 years ago, I was commissioned to write a piece about fan fiction, which is when girls write original stories that are based on the characters from, say, Harry Potter or whatever. Harry Potter's the most popular one. And I spent some time looking at the big websites there, which they, you know, they use tags and they classify stories, and you can get some sense of what people are interested in. And then about a year and a half ago, I looked back to see what had changed. And the answer is, in short, much more porny.
Yeah.
So I think there's a vicious feedback loop between what girls expect and what boys expect. Neither of them happy, actually, but both of them thinking the other is expecting a much more violent and scary sort of sexual relationship between, you know, between men and women. And that will fuel trans identification among both boys and girls.
Right.
Girls identifying out of what they see as a degrading and scary category, and boys kind of getting confused and overstimulated almost. So there's a whole load going on there, and it's changing very, very fast. And as far as I know, people aren't studying it, because if you try and study it, you get called transphobic.
Of course, yeah. And do you think when a man identifies as a woman, a lot of the time it is this, whether it's a pornified view of womanhood or perhaps it's simply a stereotypical view of womanhood, you know, is it simply the fact that we associate wearing dresses with being a woman or being submissive with being a woman?
Yeah.
Can you get away from those stereotypes when you're in this discussion at all?
Well, we don't have windows into each other's minds and feelings. So when a man identifies as a woman, like, he can't know what it feels like to be a woman, but also women don't only feel one way. And of course, the things that are ineluctably female are things that no man can do. I mean, no man can get pregnant, no man has periods, no man goes through menopause. So that can't be what he means. He might fantasize about those things, but it can't be what he means. So I think it's the signs and signifiers, which can be superficial things like long hair, nail polish or whatever. But of course, you know, lots of men quite like experimenting with those things and don't think it makes them a woman. I mean, it seems notable that men who identify as women tend to dress in a quite pornified way, frankly. Like, it's quite hooker out, you know, hooker chic, you might call it. It's never about, you know, remembering everybody's birthdays and picking up the socks and that sort of thing.
Not a nice grandma ever.
No, I think what they're identifying as is being objectified. I was thinking about this earlier today. Somebody was talking about sex work, because, you know, the sex work is work thing runs very much alongside the trans women are women. And I was thinking, you know, women find it degrading to be objectified. And I mean, a woman doesn't tend to think like that she'd like to be a prostitute. Like, it's a last chance saloon type job.
Yeah.
Like, it's what you do when you can't get anything else. Or, you know, I mean, most of them are on drugs or have had horrible life circumstances or their boyfriend is pimping them. But it's a fact that a lot of men seem to think that it would be quite exciting to be paid for sex. And they're like, you know, no one's going to pay me. But if I was a woman, they might. You know, aren't women lucky they get paid for sex, whereas we have to pay for it? I think it's one of those asymmetric things that men who are identifying as women are imagining that they'd still be men with, well, they will still be men, but I mean, with men's interests, men's attitudes, da-da-da, but they're able to slot into the woman role. Like, you know, a man who thinks, gosh, I wish people would pay me for sex, doesn't realise that if you're a woman, he wouldn't feel like that.
Yeah.
Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And when it comes to younger people, particularly young children, it seems to be the inverse. It seems to mostly, in recent years anyway, it's girls identifying as boys. And it doesn't seem that there is a sexual driver in the same way.
I mean, some people say there is. So the thrill of thinking that you might be a woman for a man is called autogynephilia, which is it's from the Greek for love of oneself as a woman. And so autoandrophilia would be what a woman might feel. And some people say there is autoandrophilia.
Right.
It doesn't seem to be anything like as common. And it does seem to be in lesbian women, if there's any of it. I mean, I this is what I've heard. I have not witnessed this at all, I have to say. But I'm just, for completeness, I'm saying there are people who say this. It does seem that the girls are identifying out of womanhood rather than into manhood. They're hoping to identify into privilege, I guess. They don't want to be objectified. There's a strange phenomenon where, you know, the man is the default human and the woman is the marked human. The gender is marked in the woman. That's the point of the title, the second sex, that men are the real humans and women are the second type of humans. So I can tell you, we don't feel like the second. I feel as fully human as any man does, you know, as far as
I just hope so.
Yes. My subjectivity feels to me as real as I think other people's subjectivity must feel to them, although I can't access it. So if you're a girl and you've registered the fact that the men are the real humans and you're the support humans, and you think, I don't feel like a support human, what you're told is that means that you feel like a man.
Yeah.
So you're being told that, you know, this idea that you identify as something, like if you identify as a girl, are you identifying as Botox and plumped lips and nail extensions and hair extensions and little handbags and very short skirts and knowing that what the porn the boys are looking at in your class, like, is very degrading about you? Like, none of that feels real. None of that feels like me, a human being. And so you're told in school now to, you know, to judge what your gender identity is, to look inwards. Well, if you look inwards and what you see is a real full human being, well, what you're seeing is not a girl, because girls aren't real human beings in that framework. So, yeah, so we're suggest selling the idea of opting out of girlhood.
Yeah. And of course, the consequences of this, if you follow that down a medical pathway, can be pretty catastrophic for boys and for girls.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's catastrophic enough to dissociate from your body and to confuse yourself about what it is, what the human condition is, and what your sexuality is too. Like, you dissociating from your body means in teen years that you're not going to register who it is you think is sexy, why, you know, what your body is telling you. So that's bad enough. But as you say, if you get medicalized, so the consequences are pretty catastrophic for both sexes, but they're earlier catastrophic for girls, because testosterone is a hell of a drug. So testosterone does a whole load of one way irreversible things to bodies. Now, that lovely beard of yours, you know, I could grow that too if I took testosterone, but you know, if you took estrogen, it wouldn't make it stop.
Right.
All those hair follicles have switched on once and once only. Mm. Same with voice dropping. If I took testosterone, my voice would drop. I would never be able to get it higher. So girls who take testosterone at 16, which is the youngest you can get it on the NHS in this country, you know, within a year, they'll have facial hair, they'll have body hair, and their voices will have broken. And if they have the gene for male pattern baldness, that'll have started too, possibly.
Right.
And also, testosterone is really terribly bad for your female sex organs. Mm. It causes atrophy of the vaginal lining. It causes the uterus to atrophy as well. So women who are on testosterone for more than a few years are going to have to get it all removed. And of course, that makes you sterilized. And boys taking estrogen, like estrogen kind of doesn't undo the things that testosterone does. Mm. So if you want to look like a girl, that feels like a tragedy. But on the other hand, if you change your mind, it's much less of a tragedy for a boy. But then the push is to try to start earlier or to block puberty so that you never go through the testosterone-driven changes. And we're really realizing that doing that is a very bad thing for a developing person, to take what are called puberty blockers, to cut off the testosterone. Like, we think that's going to have effects for your bones, for your brain, obviously for your sexual organs, because they mature during puberty, and for your future fertility and for your sex drive, by the way. How are you meant to know whether you're gay or straight if you block your puberty?
Yeah. And this can particularly affect young boys and girls who would be growing up gay.
Yeah, so as I said, gay people are more gender nonconforming by definition, because, you know, fancying someone of the same sex is very gender nonconforming. Mm. But it's also correlated with other sorts of gender nonconformity. So the research shows that people who are very notably gender nonconforming in early youth, in all sorts of ways, like little boys who want to play with dolls, little girls who want to play rugby, loads of straight people want those too. I just mean numerically. I'm just talking statistically here. You know, there's a questionnaire you can do. The one I've seen is for boys, like all sorts of questions about what little boys do. And if you're really very gender nonconforming on it when you're little, so this is pre-puberty, you're like 20 times more likely to grow up gay. So it's quite a big difference. Mm. But those are the people who are now being told they're probably girls.
Yeah.
So this is kind of like a gay conversion therapy. It's modern. Modern. It's, you know, the way we talk about modern slavery?
Yeah.
This is modern conversion therapy, turning proto-gay boys into sterile facsimiles of straight girls.
Given all the risks that this ideology seems to pose, whether it's to women's safety or to children and their fertility and their health, why is it that so many supposedly sensible people have fallen for it and allowed it to run amok in our institutions?
I call this the ideology of bad analogies. Mm. So people think, and I mean, I thought this at first too, that it's the arc of progress thing. You know, we ended slavery, we gave women the vote, we stopped tormenting gay people. You know, we now get gay marriage. The next civil rights battle.
Yeah.
And if you squint and look at it out of the corner of your eye, you know, in the wing mirror as you're going quite fast through your life, that's what it looks like. And you hear trans rights. And, you know, the thing is, you can imagine that somebody who identifies as trans has a hard road to walk.
Yeah.
And that we'll face unjustified prejudice and harassment and so on. And if you don't stop and think, yes, you know, that's true and that shouldn't happen, that doesn't mean that we can count men as women.
Yeah.
Or women as men. You just think it's the same thing. Mm. So I think most people don't see that. And then also it's the strange bedfellows problem. Like, you know, in America especially, this is seen as a Democrat-Republican issue, that Democrats are for people's human rights and Republicans, you know, if you're on that side of politics, you know, Republicans are backward.
Yeah.
They're, you know, their only reason, their only objection to this is because they're God-botherers. Mm. I mean, for the record, I'm an atheist. That is not why I care about this issue. So people just, they pigeonhole you and they write it off before they think it through. Mm. And then they're not listening to you.
Yeah.
And then if they do get a little doubt, like the other day, I was talking to somebody at one of the party, actually at the Lib Dem party conference. I was just chatting to somebody outside and I said, you know, what I did. And she said, oh, you know, I'm absolutely not gender critical. You know, as far as I'm concerned, trans women are women, but I worry about the children. And I mean, there was no point in my getting into an argument with just some random bystander. But what I should have said to her was, well, that makes you, you know, that makes you gender critical. That makes you a TERF.
Yeah.
Like, what do you think I am? Like, I'm not, I all I care about is people not being hurt. I'm just caring about people's rights. I care about the children. So if you say you care about the children, you are gender critical in the ridiculous phrase that has got attached to people who notice that there are two sexes. But if you then say it somewhere, you will get attacked. My colleague, Maya Forstatter, who founded Sex Matters, yeah. She lost her job for saying this. Mm. So people know that if they say something, they will get into trouble. So they go quiet. And then finally, I would say so much of it is so utterly ridiculous, as you said in your introduction, you know, gender fluid dachshunds and these enormous men, like vast human beings pretending to be women for the subjects of sports. Like, you know, I don't know how somebody could not laugh, but it's so ridiculous you think it can't be happening.
Yeah.
And that's part of how it's happened, because people think, no, it can't be happening. She's exaggerating. Where's her tinfoil hat?
Mm. And do you think language has played a role in this? Because I think that, say, for instance, if we weren't talking about trans women in women's prisons, for instance, it would be impossible for a male person to be put in a female prison, for a male rapist to be put in a female prison, if we weren't using that kind of language, if we didn't accommodate that kind of language.
I mean, it's entirely a linguistic movement. There's no sense in which a trans woman is a woman except linguistic.
Yeah.
Because in material reality, he's still a man because we can't change sex. So literally the only sense in which he's a woman is the language.
Yeah.
I mean, I would like people to start saying men who identify as women.
Mm.
Because it's neutral. I'm not saying claims to be or pretends to be or anything that's casting aspersions. I'm just saying he identifies as one. I'm not even very sure what identifies as means, but anyway.
Yeah.
But then it would remind everybody he's a man who identifies as a woman. And then, of course, you get to the wretched pronouns. Like, it's funny. Mm. Pronouns seem like such a small issue when you start on this. Everybody starts by like, well, I have no problem with using preferred pronouns. I was there. Yeah. I use preferred pronouns in places in my book. Because I wouldn't have got it published otherwise. But you think it's such a small thing, but as soon as you say the man is a woman, as you say, you've given away 90% of your argument.
Yeah.
Because you're left with like, oh, trans women are women. You know, she's a woman, but she's not the sort of woman who should be in women's prisons. Well, why? Well, because she's a trans woman. Oh, are you transphobic? As opposed to saying, look, he's a good, bad or indifferent man. I don't know why he identifies as a woman and I don't care, but he's not a woman, so he doesn't belong in women's prisons. But of course, all of that is described as the most vicious transphobia. Mm. So they've made it taboo to speak about material reality. But that's a much wider problem. Young people today think identities and what you identify as is unbelievably important.
Yeah. Because of course, you're not saying that all men are predators, all men are a threat. If a trans woman enters a woman's bathroom, then all hell is suddenly going to break loose. That's not really your argument. It's more subtle than that, isn't it?
It's, I don't know if it's more subtle, it's just more straightforward.
Mm.
They're not women, they're men. So if you want to have a woman-only space, you have to keep men out.
Yeah.
Like, that's the most obvious tautology. And trans women are men, so you've got to keep them out.
Yeah.
And if you say that trans women can come in, that is logically identical to saying that there can be no women-only spaces.
Mm.
Because if men can come in, they're not women-only. So then you have to say, well, why do I want women-only spaces? And I mean, safety is part of that.
Yeah.
And in particular, men who come into places where men aren't allowed to be are precisely the worst men.
Yeah.
So we're not talking about the average man. Of course, most men are not rapists. But we're not talking about the average man here. We're talking about the men who are motivated to overstep women's boundaries. They're much, much more likely to be sexually predatory than your average man. Because, I mean, most good men don't do that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Like, good men think about things like, I don't walk close behind a woman on lonely street at night. Like, you don't have to say loads of men are rapists to be aware that the guy who's following you up your living garden path might be one.
Yeah.
You know? So the men who come into women-only spaces are not good men. They are men who have listened to women saying no and have decided to ignore it.
Yeah.
So that's the main thing about safety. But that's not the only reason that we care about women-only spaces. Women need spaces where there are no men for just privacy and dignity as well.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, women, you know, men may not think this one through, but a woman who goes to the loo has to undress from the waist down. That's quite a vulnerable thing to do, even if you're in a cubicle, as you are, with the door closed. So you'd just rather a bit of built-in redundancy between you and the class of human beings that contains nearly all sexual criminals.
Yeah.
So you want your door on your cubicle and the door on the mixed toilets, and you want it around a corner, and you want it at the end of the run so that men can't hang around outside and claim plausible deniability. And all that stuff is built into standard toilet design. There's a whole load of, you know, invisible design work that went into how you make toilets safe for women. And then we say men can come in and they're not safe anymore.
Yeah. And even just in political spaces, you know, where people might not be vulnerable necessarily, surely women have a right to organise as women, lesbians as lesbians, gay men as gay men.
Yeah, I'm for single sex spaces for men too. Like, people often ask me this, like it's some sort of gotcha. And I'm like, where did I ever say that only women can have single sex spaces? So gay men in particular do need them. Like, if you're from the sexual minority, you need to be able to self-organise to support each other, but also to find sexual partners. Mm. I mean, if you're one of 2% of all men, 2 or 3% of all men at most, like, most of the people that you find sexy are never going to find you sexy. Yeah. So wouldn't it be quite nice if you could go somewhere that there are only the people who are in principle open to this as a possibility? And those of us who are straight miss that enormous privilege that most people we meet, who we regard as being in our dating pool, they would agree. Doesn't mean they want to sleep with us. I'm just talking about in principle. So yeah, of course, gay men need their own spaces. But men, you know, men who have certain vulnerabilities. So for example, a man whose wife is going through fertility treatment, it's other men he'll want to talk to. A man who has male cancers, a man who has lost his wife. It's a different experience to a wife who's lost her husband. There's all these groups that, an old friend of mine, his child died of cancer a long time ago now, and he has got a lot of support in a male-only reading group that he's been in for a long time. You know, a bunch of things have happened to these men over time, and it's each other they turn to.
Yeah.
They don't need to say women might be rapists to justify that.
Of course, yeah.
It's what they want.
Yeah. And just want to get your sense of where we are or where we're going at the moment. It seems we've got a new government. They seem to have accepted all the recommendations of the CAST review. They haven't overturned the ban on puberty blockers, which seems like good news. But are there any other things we should look out for, things we should be cautious about with this government?
Sure. So the two most important departments, like there are several important departments that this touches on, but the two important ones are health and education, and the two of them are linked. Mm. Like people who know about this talk about the school to clinic pipeline. So in schools, children are taught that what makes you a boy or a girl is what you feel like. How do you know what you feel like? You compare it to stereotypes. Well, that's making all children unhappy. It's sexist. It's misogynistic. It confuses children about material reality, and it creates gender distress. Well, those kids will in time end up in the clinic.
Yeah.
So you have to stop it in schools. But also the other way around, the clinic acts as a pull for the children in schools. So not many children have ever taken puberty blockers. It's a very small number, but their mere existence makes it possible to imagine that boys can become girls and girls can become boys, and require schools to answer the question, what do we do about a boy who says he's a girl or a girl who says he's a boy? All of that needs to stop.
Yeah.
Schools need to just start with material reality and child safeguarding. No child can change sex. We have to be clear about everybody's sex to protect children. Nobody goes into the wrong spaces. Rules are written in words. The words have to mean what they really mean. Boy, girl, male, female, he, she, boys here, girls there. Only when you have to separate the sexes. Mostly we do everything together. But when we do separate them, it has to be by sex. And that requires us to say that there's nothing a doctor could tell you that says that this boy is entitled on doctor's orders to go into the girls' spaces or vice versa. So those two departments are really closely linked, and there's a bunch of policies that cross the two of them. Schools policies, as you said, the ban on puberty blockers, the implementation of the CAS review, but also the upcoming stuff about conversion therapy.
Yeah.
So if those two departments work together well, and they return us to understanding children as, you know, mammals, born with a sex, not to be lied to or manipulated into thinking they could be the opposite sex, not confused about it, not left in danger by lying about sex, then we can get an awfully long way. And if we solve it in schools, where no one can have a gender recognition certificate because no one is over 18, then you can start to think about other spaces like prisons, rape crisis centres, changing rooms, workplaces, where all the same principles of safeguarding, dignity, privacy, fairness, and so on come up. Mm. So I think you fix it in schools, and that means those two departments. And it's very heartening to me that Wes Streeting decided to keep the ban on puberty blockers. It gives me hope that he understands these issues. And I mean, of course, he's a gay man himself.
Yeah.
So hopefully he understands that gay children, I hate saying gay children, children don't really have sexualities, proto-gay children, children who are likely to grow up gay. You know, hopefully he understands what they need. And I hope that Bridget Phillipson keeps the draft schools guidance that was written by the Conservatives, which was pretty good. Those are the two things I'm hoping for.
Helen Joyce, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me on.